it please the court, my name is Robert Hill, registration number 6873, and along with my co-counsel, I represent the plaintiff in this case. For years prior to the Supreme Court's decision in 2001 in the De Herrera case, State Farm affirmatively told each and every one of its insurers that they and their resident relatives would not have UM/UIM coverage for an accident involving their additional vehicles unless they paid separate UM/UIM premiums on each and every vehicle. Consistent with that information, State Farm included an owned but not insured exclusion, which in effect enforced that by saying you did not have it unless you purchased and paid premiums on each of your vehicles. After De Herrera, State Farm knew that was incorrect, and they knew that the OB&I exclusion in their policies was invalid and unenforceable. The core question presented by this case is whether State Farm, having inaccurately informed their insureds for years, communicated the changes brought about by De Herrera in a manner and with sufficient clarity to bring them to the attention of the insureds and to allow them to make an informed decision about purchasing UM/UIM by paying premiums on multiple vehicles.
Mr. Hill, may I ask you, is this question an objective test or a subjective test?
Your Honor, it's very clearly an objective test. And it's important to step back and understand why that's important. And that is a protection for the defendant. If we think about a disclosure duty on a defendant dealing with thousands of consumers, as we have here, if you have a subjective test, each and every individual could come in and say, well, I had a unique circumstance. I needed to know A. I needed to know B. I needed to know C. So long ago, this court, Colorado Supreme Court, initially, in Morrison versus Goodspeed, I think was the case in 1937, long ago they decided we're going to use an objective standard. Because that's the only way that the defendant can be protected from essentially unique needs by individual insureds. So one of the issues that's very important to understand here, and it was set forth in the Briggs decision not too long ago, that the test is not whether someone would have made a different purchasing decision, but whether a person might have made a different purchasing decision. And that law goes back to 1937. It was followed by the Supreme Court in Ackerman in 1982. It's been decided multiple times, and I may address that a little bit more later. But very clearly, it's an objective standard based on Colorado law.
Right, and your argument here on the summary judgment piece is that the expert testimony of the linguist and the insurer who provided the affidavit shows why there's at least a fact question on exactly what an objectively reasonable person would have done.
Exactly. Okay. We also argued, I want to say, Your Honor, that because the OB&I remain in the policy, which was contrary to De Herrera, and because if you look at the notice, it has a blocked-in portion on the notice which says you have to refer over to the policy, and which is typical. The policy controls, not the individual communications. So you have a policy in existence, and including UOB&I at the time of the notice, and continuing for months after that notice. So if people got the notice, and then they did what they were told, and they looked at the policy, they would see the UOB&I in there, and they would see it either being not covered or being at least inconsistent and ambiguous. We also looked at the express language. I mean, all they would have had to do is add, I think it's about 12 words according to our expert, which would have been basically to say it covers you wherever you are in whatever vehicle you're in. All they would have had to say in this two-page notice that has several hundred words is the OB&I is invalid and will not be enforced. And under the Parfrey-type test, where you look at the totality of circumstances, one of them should be, how difficult would it have been for them to accurately inform the consumer? We say that should have been an issue for the trier of fact. As you know, I'm sure from the briefing, we've challenged both the summary judgment ruling and the decertification ruling. I don't want to say it the right way. I always feel a little presumptuous telling a court what they meant by both fair and decent decisions. And so I'm a little nervous as I sit here and argue.
I'd like to know what we...
So I'm going to do it very carefully.
I was very interested to read the district court's view on my case.
Yes, I was too. I do want to say, with humility, that I think the recent rulings of both this Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, and members of this court are inconsistent with fundamental rulings that the trial court has to have relied upon in reaching her decision, and that State Farm, to be candid in their briefing, has argued. We argue first that the trial court's ruling was erroneously premised on the assumption that State Farm's disclosure duties arose solely out of the UMUIM statute. That's directly contrary to this court's decision in Wagner versus Travelers, which is a related case involving similar facts, where the court expressly ruled that an insurer's disclosure duties are broader in scope than its duties under the UM statute and were not amenable to summary judgment because of the existence of disputed issues of material fact. That's consistent also, I would say, with the decision in the Briggs case. The trial court's ruling was also erroneously premised on an assumption that the adequacy of the notice was a matter of law that could be determined despite disputed issues of material fact. That's directly contrary to the Supreme Court's decision in Greenberg versus Perkins, where the court said it's for the trial court to determine whether a duty exists, the scope of that duty, but it's for the fact finder to determine whether the defendant breached that duty. That's also inconsistent with this court's recent decision in Sosian, and I'm not sure how to pronounce that, versus Vail, where this court determined that a duty existed, defined the scope of the duty, just as the law says we should, but ruled that the issue of compliance with that duty was a question of fact to be resolved by the trier of fact. The trial court directly addressed that issue and said, plaintiffs argue that this is a disputed issue of fact precluding summary judgment. State Farm argues it's a matter of law to determine whether or not the notice complied. I determine that it's a matter of law, and I would suggest that those cases are directly contrary. Third, the trial court erroneously ruled as a matter of law that State Farm's continued inclusion of the OB&I in its policies could not have created confusion in the minds of its insurers. In fact, it dismissed my arguments and all of our arguments and all of our evidence by saying that, quote, most people of ordinary intelligence would not recognize the term and they would not recall the use of the term in their policies, close quote. That's in the summary judgment order at page 6. I want to respectfully suggest that that decision and that ruling ignoring the OB&I is inconsistent with this court's ruling in Briggs. In that opinion, the court determined that an insurer, quote, that an insurer that includes an OB&I exclusion in its policies fails to satisfy the disclosure obligations. In this case of Wagner versus Travelers, another related case, the court held that, quote, the inclusion of the OB&I exclusion in the insurance policy post de Herrera may well be affirmatively misleading, thereby precluding summary judgment. And as I say, we can go on and on and on through the issues relating to that. The actual notice itself says there's a change. It doesn't ever tell people that that change results in this coverage following them, no matter what the vehicle they're in.
Mr. Hill, can I ask you a question? And this, I guess it's two related questions, and given your time is limited, I'll get them both out and let you respond. You have argued, and I think correctly in the law, I don't think there's disagreement, that you've got to show a theory that would apply on a class-wide basis. I confess that I'm not 100% clear on what that theory is, so I would appreciate if you would address that. And second, one thing you didn't address in your recitation just now was the data that State Farm provides. I think we can all agree that Bensing said the court can look at the substantive claims and defenses without deciding the merits. Here it seems the court said, well, 97% of the people re-upped even after getting the notice. You say, well, the court's assuming the notice was adequate. Doesn't that suggest you have to look at each individual case? So I'd appreciate your response. That's, of course, State Farm's argument, and I'd appreciate your rebutting that for us, if you would.
Our theory, if you will, for establishing the reliance issues, the connection between the wrong and the damage, was based upon circumstantial evidence, not unlike in BP America, to be candid, Your Honor. And notably, if you read her order, decertification order, at pages 17 to 18, She says, quite properly, that she found plaintiff had advanced a viable theory for proving reliance on State Farm misrepresentation on a class-wide basis based on circumstantial evidence. And then she made and went on, and this is where we suggest she created error. She went on to say that because the evidence suggested, and to be honest, Your Honor, we objected to that evidence. We thought it was inappropriate. I've always been embarrassed. I felt a little blindsided, and that's my fault. I'm not blaming anybody else. I don't think we did a good job of handling that once she ruled that it was going to be admitted.
But statistical, or State Farm's data.
State Farm data. We've subsequently had more discovery on that, and if we had a different day, I'd have a different argument. But putting that aside, Your Honor, when she went to that, what I think she did was to jump over the test of what the plaintiff would have had to show and then what the class members would have to show. As I indicated earlier, if we look at the cases right up to the supplemental case that was filed, that we filed in our supplemental order, the test here is not what people would have done. In fact, I want to say, and I wish I had the quote, I'll get it here for a second if I fumble. I'll apologize for it. The court should not look, should look at the form of the notice, or the form of the offer, the form of the information, not at what purchase decision was made. And that's because of the objective standard. And if you look at the Thompson versus Budget Rental Car, an older case from this court, what they said there was, there the person had admitted, I wouldn't have taken the offer even if you'd told me about it. Couldn't be clearer. I wouldn't have taken it even if you told me about it. The court said, that's not it. We're not going to let a defendant put them to trial on what they would have done. That's too speculative, and it would defeat the legislative purpose. The question is, what's the offer? And I'm going to reserve the rest of my time, and I will have that quote when I come back. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Michael McCarthy appearing on behalf of State Farm, registration number 6688. State Farm's response to the Supreme Court's opinion in D. Herrera stands apart from the manner in which all other insurance carriers in this state dealt with the D. Herrera decision in terms of advising its insurers what their rights were with respect to uninsured motorist coverage. As I know the panel is well aware, because members of the panel have sat off cases that have been spawned by the D. Herrera litigation, those cases, none of them presented a circumstance in which the insurance carrier promptly provided to its insureds notice of the effect of the D. Herrera opinion. The notice that State Farm sent out to its insurers within months and in the next policy cycle following the D. Herrera opinion was adequate as a matter of law. There was no disputed issue of fact with respect to the contents of that notice. There was no disputed issue of fact as to the means by which that notice was distributed. There was no disputed issue of fact as to who got the notice.
Mr. McCarthy, if I can interrupt you, and you're getting ahead of steam, I apologize. But how do you respond to the linguist in particular? And I'll confess I'm troubled by this piece of your argument. You have a linguist who, as I understand it, says a reasonable person would not have understood this, would have been confused by this. There was also at least one insured who gave an affidavit, said, I certainly didn't understand it. I recognize you vehemently disagree with those, but why doesn't that give you a fact question on whether the notice was adequate?
Your Honor, because it's what you do as a judge. It's what any of you do. It's what Judge Mallard was entitled to do. She had the ability to make the threshold determination about whether what was submitted to her, given the fact that the language was not in dispute, the language of that notice was not in dispute. It was within her authority to determine that there were no disputed issues of fact, and in a case like this where you're judging the adequacy of a notice, it is, in in really simplest terms, what judges do. There always are going to be circumstances where a plaintiff can say, I didn't understand that. Well, the judge's job and what the judge is entitled to say is that the plain language within the four corners of this was enough. And there were two judges that had said that, Your Honor. I think it's important to emphasize. Not only did Judge Mallard find that, but also Federal Judge Figa found that in his 2004 ruling in the Anderson case. Judge Figa looked at this and said that this notice is an effective means of advising State Farm's insurers that this information is adequate and it communicates to them exactly what they need to know. And Judge Figa was affirmed by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Do you happen to know, Mr. McCarthy, and this may be an unfair question, was there an affidavit like this linguist in that other case in front of Judge Figa? Do you know?
It was our case, and I don't believe there was. And Your Honor, I would say that it was within the province of the trial court to say that the linguist affidavit does, it's the judge's job, not the linguist's job, to determine whether or not the language is adequate to advise the insureds.
Would you agree with Mr. Hill, Mr. McCarthy, that the existence and scope of a duty is a matter of law for the court, but an issue of breach is a fact question for the jury or the fact finder?
The issue of what, Your Honor?
The scope and existence of a duty is for the court. Whether there's a breach of the duty is for the fact finder. I think that's what Mr. Hill said. I think that's how I remember the law. Do you agree with that or disagree?
Your Honor, actually, I would not agree with that because the breach is a function of the adequacy of the notice. And so the judge is entitled to determine the scope of the notice, but also if there's no disputed issue of fact, they're entitled to determine the adequacy of the notice as well. There's been some discussion of the Vail ski case in terms of whether it was adequate. In that instance, there was a fact question as to whether the sign was visible. There was no question here about whether the content of this, there was no question here about the content of this language. And one thing that I would emphasize in particular about the nature of the notice that hasn't been really developed here in some of the argument is that at the end of the day, what the notice said to State Farm's insurers was that your UM insurance has changed. And if you have a question about it, talk to your agent. So it was inquiry, at a minimum, it was inquiry notice to the insured that if you have any question or any confusion about whether or not you should pay that additional premium for an additional car, talk to your agent. And another thing that has to be brought out is the fact that State Farm in 2001 briefed its agency task force and told them, if you have policyholders coming into them, tell them about this case. Tell them if they buy it for one car, they can have it for all. At the end of the day, what Judge Mallard said, and I think what she said is right on, is that what the law requires is an effective means of communicating the information. It does not require perfection. So what we have here is an effort to create a disputed issue of fact by the provision of a linguist affidavit, when at the end of the day, it is to the judicial officer who's hearing the case, ultimately for the Court of Appeals, for you to say, this is a question that this panel can answer. Was it an adequate notice?
I'll leave you be on this last question. As I understand the standard from Parfrey, the duty of notification has to be performed in a manner reasonably calculated to permit the potential person to make an informed decision and goes on. Your argument is that no reasonable juror could have found from this linguist that standard, that if there's a fact question.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that's what Judge Mallard concluded and that's what Judge Figa concluded.
Thank you.
In the Tenth Circuit. Let me turn to the class certification issue, which in kind of the colloquial terms, class certification here is really the guts ball issue. It's the 23B3 determination that Judge Mallard made here, that there was an inadequate showing on the part of the plaintiff to determine that there were a predominance of common issues of fact, was based upon the evidence that we presented at a 2.5-day evidentiary hearing before Judge Mallard in Boulder District Court. What that evidence showed, without significant controversy from the plaintiff was that there was meaningful coverage that was available to an insured when they paid additional premium for each car, that non-resident relatives and guest passengers would be entitled to coverage only if that additional premium was paid for each car. And so our point here, in terms of the question that has been asked by the Supreme Court and Judge Bender and by Justice Bender in the Benson cases, is the case triable as a class? The point that we made before Judge Mallard, the point we make to this panel, is that the case isn't triable as a class because you have to measure not only the claims that are being advanced by the plaintiff, but also the defenses that are being advanced by State Farm. And here what State Farm says is that we have a due process right to be able to show that each and every policyholder would have wanted to, in fact, buy that additional coverage, and it's not dependent on the summary judgment order. The creation of those individualized questions of fact is not dependent on the validity of the summary judgment order, because even if you say you don't get summary judgment on the notice doesn't go away. The notice was still out there. The conduct of the policyholders was still out there. And so what we would be able to do as a matter of due process at trial is say, wait a minute, you don't just get to roll over us with a shortcut presumptive establishment of the burden that you had to show reliance and causation. What we have a right to do to defend this case, where we've got 850,000 notices going out to insurance here, is to show that each and every one of them actually wanted that, and the State Farm data demonstrated and allowed us to show is that after the notice went out, most of the people, whether they completely understood it or not, but they had information, they were told to talk to their policyholders, most of those persons chose to continue the coverage and pay those additional premiums.
Doesn't that depend on the clarity and the adequacy of the notice? I thought that's what Judge Mallard was saying, that since the notice was adequate and clear, the fact that people then decided not to buy the insurance on their second vehicle was meaningful. But if the notice wasn't clear, then the decision not to buy it on the second vehicle, I'd say, would not be meaningful. But maybe I'm misunderstanding.
What Judge Mallard said was that she was operating on the assumption that she'd entered her summary judgment. I recognize that. But the record goes beyond just the validity of that summary judgment. And the record also contemplates the fact, Your Honor, that the notice said, if you have a question, talk to your agent. The record established that State Farm's agents were fully advised about what they needed to tell their policyholders if they came to them with questions. And I think what the record also showed through the witnesses that we presented was that that's how most people buy insurance. They go to their insurance agent, they talk to the agent, they don't read every single line with a magnifying glass to confirm. They go to their agent and say, hey, should I buy this coverage or shouldn't I? If I shouldn't, why shouldn't I? If I should, why should I? And that's why, at the end of the day, what State Farm thought was one of the most important things that it did when it wrote the notice was to say, if you've got a question, talk to your agent. And so, Your Honor, that's why I say the inquiry notice is really a critical point here, because what people knew, they weren't just looking at the notice. They had the ability to interact with their agent and ask those questions.
You're saying even if we were to find the notice inadequate, we could still affirm the decision to deny a class certification. That's what you're suggesting, right?
That's right.
Is the converse also true? Actually, I think that's a question I want to ask Mr. Hill. If you find that the notice was adequate, does that end our inquiry in terms of the class certification?
If you find that the notice was adequate, I wouldn't say you should end your inquiry. Because what the notice adequacy summary judgment really did is it cut off the class period, if you will. What it said is that after the notice went out on December 14, 2001, no further claims are going to be recognized because it's adequate. What I would say is that in adjudicating the propriety of Judge Mallard's denial. She granted a motion to decertify under an abuse of discretion standard. In evaluating whether or not she abused her discretion in deciding that individualized issues predominate, I think you go further. I mean, I think you look at the arguments that we've made, and in fact,
that being the case, then I want to ask you why this doesn't describe this case. In a very erudite opinion on class actions, a judge wrote, presuming or inferring reliance is particularly compelling when there is evidence that a defendant intentionally withheld information to induce the very action that the plaintiffs took. That's BP. Why doesn't that apply here?
Doesn't apply here because there's no evidence of that. There's absolutely no evidence that there was an intentional withholding of information.
As opposed to that memo in BP where they said, let's not tell the people who might induce litigation. That's basically the difference.
There's zero. There's nothing here. Mr. Hill started off his argument by saying for all these years, State Farm told his policyholders that they needed to buy this extra coverage. Well, the thing that he forgot to tell you, but I'm sure you all know this, is that they did that in reliance of five opinions from this court which said the owned but not insured exclusion was valid. The other thing that I will mention is that Mr. Hill emphasized the fact that the OB&I exclusion was left in the policy at the same time that the notice was being sent out. Important point chronologically to keep in mind there. De Herrera did not invalidate the owned but not insured exclusion. It did not do so. But even more importantly, the validity of the owned but not insured exclusion was being litigated in front of this court in the Hymas case, and it was being hotly contested. And it up through a petition to the Supreme Court for certiorari, and it was only in February of 2002, roughly coextensive with the point in time when State Farm removed the owned but not insured exclusion, that the Hymas decision of this court squarely addressed the invalidity of the OB&I exclusion. So we didn't say the OB&I exclusion had been ruled invalid because it hadn't been ruled invalid at the point in time when we sent the notice out. Instead, what we said is that we said what De Herrera said, that uninsured motorist coverage has changed in this state, and if you've got a question about that, please go talk to your agent. Thank you very much.
Quickly try to respond to the questions I've heard already and then ask for others. The quote that I was looking for is in the Cardenas versus Financial Indemnity Company, where it says, quote, a court should consider only the adequacy of the offer, not whether an insured would have purchased the coverage had it been properly offered. And it's consistent with the theme of those cases. Judge Richmond, your question that you indicated was coming my way is that absolutely you have to address both. The summary judgment issue is one of three reasons why we say the decertification order was improper. The second is if the plaintiff is not required to show they would have made a different purchasing decision, certainly the class members cannot be required to prove a different purchasing decision. So the fact is that when they say they want to have everybody come in and say, would you have purchased it even if you had been properly informed, that's a question that no one has to answer in this case, but that's not an element of the proof of our case. And that's consistent with your holding in Briggs and with the long line of cases where it doesn't make a difference whether they did or did not purchase as a result or would or would not have purchased. In fact, in the Thompson case, the fellow said, I wouldn't have purchased even if you told me. The same thing is true if you look at the Benzing case, where they say the fact that he had testified that he would have made no different decision was an improper intrusion by the trial court into the merits at that time of the stage. The third is that if you look at the BP America decision, I think you'll find, just as there, just as here, we had numerous overriding common issues. That doesn't mean there wouldn't be some individual issues that would have to get addressed. And the very same thing was true in BP America. And I think I could sort of track, if I had time, the kind of issues that were there. The trial court found them to be there and still certified it. The Court of Appeals approved it with that. And some individual issues remaining. It wouldn't be, though, whether or not people made the same or different purchase decision, because that is not what we are required to prove for our case.
Mr. Hill, if I can ask you, let's assume for purposes of my question, you're correct that there was a fact question on the adequacy of the notice. Why doesn't that virtually automatically get you to individual questions predominating? If there's a fact question and you've got the data, don't you have to look at each person? And related to that, I'll point out, in BP, there were maybe five questions that came up after. Here, you got 97% of the people. And so in both cases, the trial court made a balancing. And so here, the court did the balancing and said predominant issues, individual issues predominate.
Your Honor, one is that the elements you're talking about, the only thing the state darn data says is that people continue to purchase after receiving this notice. Now, I'll tell you, there's a dramatically different rate, but nonetheless, a lot of them did continue to purchase. But that's not a question. My client would not have to show that. The Goodspeed versus Morrison case, the person was dead. There was no evidence about what that person would have done or not done if provided the information. That's because the objective test is the criteria. That's why this court could say just 3 months ago, a court should consider only the adequacy of the offer, not whether an insured would have purchased the coverage had it been properly offered. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes.